Hello and welcome to the Smashy Business Show. Today is Thursday, April 17th, 2025, and I'm Werd Ahmed.
And I'm Richard Fitzgerald.
And we've got a great show for you today. Now, for today's headlines, firstly, we're going to be discussing how the UAE is topping Saudi Arabia's Arab export markets in Q4 2024. Secondly, we have an update on Bleban, the famous dessert brand in Egypt, has actually shut down over five stores over licensing violations. We're also going to discuss how Red Sea Global has unveiled a new island despite Saudi Arabia's public investment fund budget cuts. Women have invested 118 billion dirhams in Dubai's real estate sector. And finally, this is just an international touch, we're going to discuss how Chinese brands are flooding TikTok. How are you today, Richard?
Very good, Ward. Thanks for letting me join the show and taking Majid's hot seat.
It's really nice to have you today. Now, for the first topic, the UAE has topped Saudi Arabia's Arab export markets in Q4 2024.
Yeah, trade surplus soars 37%. So Saudi Arabia's trades with Arab countries hit big numbers in the last quarter of 24. UAE was top export destination. So we're talking, you know, October, November, December. It's Riyadh season, weather's good, and Saudi are importing $6.27 billion exporting into the UAE.
Now, right behind the UAE, Bahrain took in around $2.25 billion, Egypt at $2.24 billion, followed by Oman with $1.18 billion, and Jordan at $800 million.
Yeah, if you add it all up, Saudi's trades with Arab countries, including GCC, roughly got $23 billion. Now, this is all good for sort of economies that are trying to get to Saudi's trillion-dollar GDP. That's about 70% of the kingdom's total global trade. Significant from the Gulf. It's nice to see these countries, not relying totally on global trade, that they can trade between each other and help each other grow.
Yeah, and I think that's a really great point, too, because of the fact that, you know, we're seeing with Trump's tariffs. I remember me and Majid brought up this point that because of the fact that Saudi has developed such a strong free market, you know, they have their own goods, they have their own brands that are rising and becoming extremely successful, so that might ease what the tariffs might do in 90 days. Now, Saudi's trade surplus with the Arab League nations jumped 37.3% year on year, hitting around $8.18 billion for the quarter.
Yeah, exactly. This is all part of the bigger Vision 2030. You know, when the Vision 2030 was announced and, when MBS became Crown Prince around 2017, it felt like a long way away, but now we're sort of 5 years away. So there's growing non-oil exports and tightening regional ties, especially with the UAE, firmly holding its spot as Saudi's number one Arab partner. It's quite cool, right? Like the UAE and Saudi are really sort of aligned leadership and aligned economically as well.
And I remember there was a time at the end of last year when me and Majid were discussing FII, and we just noticed how every single person who would visit the UAE would then right after meet with the Crown Prince of Dubai, His Highness Sheikh Hamdan. And I think that's like a sign of how they're really aligned. I would say that it's almost kind of like a kind competition. I don't think it seems. What do you think, Rich?
Yeah, I was speaking to a lawyer in Saudi last week, and we were talking about Program HQ and headquarters in Saudi and things like that. And I just sometimes think that the media, us and others, and narratives pick up the obvious thing, or the thing that they like to sort of write about. So when Saudis say that, you know, it's better that you have your headquarters in Riyadh for the region, you know, the Saudi lawyer told me it's to take the companies from Dubai to there. Why? You know, what if a company doesn't even have presence in the region? Then how are they taken from Dubai? Right? And what if the 30-year tax incentive of no 20% corporate tax to attract a global conglomerate into Riyadh means that that company opens an office in Dubai that was never in Dubai in the first place? So we just look at the simple stuff. And I think sometimes it's pay grade. Sometimes people who have a job and a KPI to hit see competition, whether you're in the retail sector, tourism sector, or the F&B or the hospitality, and you go, oh, now I have more competition. Therefore, Saudi is the competition. hang on. And I think it needs sort of mature regional alliance and leadership, which we've got, and these metrics show it, that like rising boats, right? You know, the economies are growing overall, and intertrade here is better than intertrade elsewhere. Like you mentioned free markets, yeah, but what are the import-export tariffs between the UAE and KSA? I'm not sure, but there's always some sort of tariff, right? Like what, you know, are there indirect tariffs? There's shipping costs, there's portal costs, there's entry fees and things like that. But, you know, of these billions of dollars, right, like, you know, how much of that is going direct to business people, or how much is that is, you know, being supported to build shipping and trade and things like that? You know, we saw that, you commented yesterday that Saudi are paying off, which is a minimal sum, the world debt, government debt,
yeah,
of
the
Syria.
$15 million.
And then the narrative there is that, like, okay, so Saudi now is going to have a trade route from Qatar for gas into Europe through Syria, right? So, you know, this is speculation, but like, So what's going to pay for that? Is it the, you know, is it the semi-state entities? Is it the governments? Or is it the private sector? So yeah, you know, general point about competition. I'm not really sort of going to amplify the narrative that it's Dubai versus Riyadh, because it's not, right. Like it's you know at some, and if you're the head of a football club. And someone signs a player in another football club, ultimately the league wins, right? Like you might, as a manager, you might suffer that the other club is doing well, but ultimately the league wins. And I think ultimately the GCC is winning here, and the Gulf is winning here, and the wider Arab,
I see what you mean.
Yeah.
What matters is that we're all winning.
Yeah, but I don't think competition is linear. I don't think competition is. I also don't think it's a net sum game in an emerging market. Obviously nation states and countries have GDP targets and security and safety and investments to look after the people. But like an emerging market. It really is about, the wider sort of region and the wider sort of benefits.
You know what it also is, Rich? Lately, I just, for some reason, I've been meeting a lot of Saudis, and I've been speaking to them. I'm like, oh, are you seeing what's going on in Saudi? I think it's because I'm writing about it every single day. And the same sentence that I keep hearing from Saudi Arabian people is that, you know, Saudi's always been great. It's always been doing well. You just didn't know. We just didn't tell you. And I just find that really interesting. It's almost like a sleeping giant that was always there. It's just more of us are actually finding out now. But speaking of giants, right now, one of the largest dessert chain giants in Egypt has actually announced 8 store closures. Now, according to Cairo 24, what basically happened is that 8 Bleben stores closed, and 4 of the other stores, known as Blin, copycats of Bleben, were also asked to close. And it wasn't actually due to poisoning; it was due to license violations. And I think
apparently the guy behind it is Dr. Mohammed Amar with a veterinary background, which is interesting in terms of the link with dairy. They started only in 2021. You know, I thought this brand had a lot of heritage, but they expanded super quickly. And they grew across 120 outlets across 9 countries: Morocco, Saudi, Jordan, Qatar, and UAE. I'm not sure exactly how many are in Egypt.
Also Kuwait, Morocco, Libya, even recently. Oh, they're opening their first store in Kuwait tomorrow.
Okay.
I think it's one of the quickest expansions I've ever seen in my life. And the reason, I know you're thinking, like, Ward, why are you always chasing after this story? It's because I'm a fan of Bleben. I love Bleben. You know, in Ramadan, I ordered it every single day.
Every day?
Yes, my family was obsessed. It would make my mom so happy. They have a dish, it's called kushari, and it's basically ruz bilaban. It's rice with milk. They top it with kunafa, and then they cover it in whatever topping you want. Pistachio, lotus, Nutella, whatever it is. So I think this is why it's so shocking for me. It was doing so well. So I'm,
but maybe it's I think you covered Barnes, the coffee chain, yesterday, and you know, franchises that grow fast are going to have media conversations around them. I'm sure there are some countries that McDonald's store is closed in. McDonald's have had series of PR disasters over the last 30, 40 years, you know, in terms of obesity, in terms of product, in terms of supplies, and where they're getting their poultry from, and all sorts of stuff. And I think, you know, I love the statement that Blaben came out with saying we're not angels. In other words, in reading between the lines, maybe they haven't got their paperwork done. And, you know, poisoning is health and safety, and it's scary in Saudi if that's the case. You know, and we covered that story at length, and it's good that the regulatory system is in place to make sure things come back stronger for Blaben and Saudi. But in Egypt, what is the regulation around stores in Egypt? Is it the same? Because if you spend time in Egypt, you'll know that there's a lot of, or even Sudan or other parts of North Africa, that there's a lot of street vendors around food. It's part of the culture. It's part of the regulation. And, you know, if we think back, and you and I were just discussing this off air, the start of the Arab Spring started because the government in Tunisia went heavy on a street vendor with taxes, and he then, you know, set himself afire because he was already struggling to make ends meet. But you were taxing. So did this person have the license to sell corn in the street or whatever the food stuff was? But, you know, so this is the next level of that, right? It's kind of like, okay, the age of the stores or so are being shut down because maybe they haven't filed the right paperwork or they haven't done their audits or whatever. And that's growing pains. If you're going this fast, 130, yeah, probably more in 5 years, yeah.
I think it's because of the quick expansion. But, you know, something that Blaben, a really interesting thing that they said on their message, by the way, they posted it on Facebook. Yeah, the message was there. Something really interesting.
Which is significant because Egypt's so big on Facebook still.
Yeah, and something that they said was, you know, in the end of the day, like, please remember that these are 25,000 employees. Now, before, they've never actually provided a specific number for it, but they said that these are 25,000 employees whose livelihoods you're affecting. So, you know, before you speculate, before you post certain videos to push a certain narrative, because there's this video going out around, it's with one of their social media marketeers, it's one of their employees, and basically what he was doing, he was holding a date. They were filming. He was holding a date with one of their really large baskets, and he bit it, and then he threw it into the basket. And every single news outlet actually used, I believe it was Blinks, they used that video, and they were like, you know, ew, like, people are finding that disgusting. And I'm wondering to myself, what if maybe those large baskets, they're just for the video? Maybe that's not something that's being provided to customers. I don't know. I really don't know. But I did have a friend tell me. I did have a friend. I felt bad.
You're their message.
No, seriously. Yeah. I had empathy for their message. I really felt bad. I mean, even yesterday when I was publishing the story, my mom was speaking to me because Sudanese people are really big on things like that. They, in Arabic, what do they call it? They say it's ma taqta' damir zol. Like, don't cut someone's opportunity, you know? And she was looking at me, and she was like, you really shouldn't be too excited about this story. But it's just, you know, I'm wondering, maybe that's what it is. But a Sudanese person did tell me that Blaben tastes better here than in Egypt, because they live in Egypt. After the war, they moved. They said that it tastes better here. But on the regulations that you mentioned, by the way, do you know that cola and Pepsi in Sudan taste way better than what it tastes in this region because their sugar content is not regulated? It's not regulated, so they can put as much sugar as they want into Coke and Pepsi. So, it tastes insane in Sudan, but I just... What do you think, Rich?
Yeah, no, it's interesting. Was it on this show that you mentioned about Trump and water? Did you mention that?
Oh, I think it was Majid. Yes, yeah, Majid something was about the one water. Who mentioned it.
In terms of sugar, it's good. I mean, at least if the sugar cane has been made in Africa or Egypt, then at least someone's benefiting from that. But yeah, look, you know... Let's cheer on Barnes Coffee in Saudi, and let's cheer on Blaben for the region. You know, like, let's hope they go public. Let's hope there's more jobs. Let's hope these businesses grow. Let's hope the knock-on effect. So if Blaben has marketing budget, like, you know, how many jobs has McDonald's marketing job budget created for agencies for in Dubai, and how many campaigns have happened, how many over the years, Coca-Cola international brands. If we're looking at a multipolar, unipolar world where globalization is no longer the be-all and end-all, yeah. then who's going to take the place of globalization? Okay, we've got governments here who are doing things that other governments did. In other words, you know, looking after imports and exports and regulation. Then we need chains, we need restaurants, we need brands. Mm-hmm. And let's go, Balab. And I like it. I like the story.
Have you tried the food?
I have in Global Village. Yeah, I mean, my wife tried it. And we had a lot of... We had two mango dishes. I didn't have the one that you described. I'm not sure, yeah.
I think it was that. Was it like a light cake? Or yeah. Like a light milk cake? Yeah, yeah. That's the Ashtuta.
Yeah, yeah. But tried it in Global Village. And yeah, like it's not only a regional brand, but it's a regional dish. It's regional cuisine. And the lines were there and they had their own unique style. But every chain that grows has its kind of unique style and unique trend.
But you know what it also is with Blaben? I once heard this thing that... Because basically Mazen Kanaan, the Lebanese founder of House of Pops, a very successful, healthy ice cream business in the Middle East, he basically went on to LinkedIn and he asked the question of, why are we suddenly hearing all of your negative opinions now? You know, he said that maybe what if the issue here is the fact that you guys weren't honest with this brand from the beginning and gave them your opinions about whether you think the sugar is too much, about the way that things are being done. Why are you giving your opinions now? Do you maybe think that it's a good idea to be honest with businesses from the start so that they can actually be successful? And I think that in the case of Blaben, I really do think too much marketing is bad. It's almost like propaganda. There's so much good in front of your face that if you have a bad opinion, you almost think to yourself, should I give this opinion? Is it just me? And I think that's what happened with the customers that Blaben has. For our next story, we're going to be discussing how Red Sea Global has unveiled a new island. And this is despite the budget cuts that were applied by Saudi Arabia's nearly $1 trillion public investment fund.
Yeah, fascinating. So in Saudi, Red Sea Global, obviously Red Sea touches other countries as well, but the Saudi Red Sea Global has officially unveiled Lahek Island.
Yeah.
The first development beyond phase one of its 23.6 billion Red Sea Giga project.
Now, this announcement comes amid significant budget cuts across the $925 billion public investment fund's portfolio, according to Bloomberg. Now, sources report spending reductions of up to 60% across more than 100 PIF-owned companies following a board decision made in December. Now, Red Sea Global and NEOM are reportedly among the hardest hits.
Yeah, you know, despite this, Lahek Island is moving ahead, spanning 400 hectares. It's scheduled to open in 2028, so, you know, 3 years away, as a high-end residential and luxury tourism destination. The project's centerpiece is called The Ring. For people watching on Smashy TV on the app or on smart TV devices, we'll be able to see the stunning ring-shaped island. It will stretch 800 meters wide, featuring luxury apartments, hotels, retail, and 115-berth marina. Plans also include sailing schools, water sports, 18-hole golf course, and two luxury resorts, all designed by UK-based architects, very famous ones, Foster and Partners.
Now, Red Sea Global aims to deliver 11 resorts at the Red Sea and 8 resorts by Amana by 2025. So we're going to see them by the end of this year. Now, by 2030, the full project is set to include 50 resorts, 8,000 hotel rooms, and over 1,000 residences across 22 islands and 6 inland locations, targeting 19 million annual visitors. I think you've gone, Rich.
Yeah.
How was it like?
Unbelievable.
How did you feel?
Unbelievable. Ooh. Yeah, we went to New Year's Eve, actually, for New Year's. Yeah, kind of a honeymoon for 4 days. Went to St. Regis, Red Sea, near... So there's kind of three beside each other there. And you sort of fly into this... brand new airport. It's a bit like the Alula airport, but it's a brand new airport. Not all the airlines go there yet. And you see John Pagana, the CEO of Red Sea Global, always on LinkedIn signing new deals. He announced this project yesterday. And this is a good communications, right? And they also announced that they signed deals with Fly Dubai. So there's two flights a week, right? And like, you know, the airport's pretty small, but very luxurious, very sort of like a destination hotel, not like an international, airport, not an international airport. And they had another terminal, which is even more high-end, I think, for, you know, private jets or, you know, luxury jets and stuff. So you go in and then the car takes you to the boat. You can either take a seaplane like Maldives or you can go on a boat. The waters were quite choppy. It was quite cold. But we went on a 30-40 minute boat journey. And then we ended up on this beautiful project, beautiful island. And while they did, what's the word, landscape it, and while they did build this structure with these sort of, you know, you see the pictures of the sort of Maldives type structure of these resorts, and then there's some on land. It is really fascinating to see how beautiful the natural landscape there was, and to think that that remained untouched for this Saudi state's 100-year history, to think that it was just there and that they looked after it. And even, you know, John Pagano always writes about, you know, any research around the Red Sea Project is how they're actually doing extra measures to not only preserve existing wildlife and coral, but also to allow more to develop naturally or organically and things like that. So, yeah, the numbers and the number of resorts are fascinating. I think 23 five-star hotels total. Amala is the other project. Red Sea is one area. And these things are just coming online really, really fast. And they're active, they're busy. And you know, you spend a few days on the resort and you listen to the people who've come from different countries and different hotel brands and, you know, Saudi hospitality students earning livings there and the different culinary skills, the different sort of amenities. You know, it really is talking about economy and tourism, and they really are building something quite.
I have a question. What kind of people visited the area? Was it only Saudis? Was it, you know, what was the crowd like?
I'm complete curious. Mix, complete mix. Like some Arab diaspora, some, you know, Levant people, some Gulf people, some, you know, we heard Saudi prince has an area there, one Saudi prince of many, that, you know, and then international European young couples with their young children, wider families, you know, with grandparents and kids. So complete mix. Like, and I think it is interesting to see how this stuff develops. Like, you are seeing obviously influencers and media and likewise go there. But I think we sort of, time passes, and I think some of these projects have been online. You know, Alula has been online for about 5, 6, 7 years, and you know, some of these projects develop, and you'd be surprised how many people are going here. Like, tourism is on the rise. These projects keep going, and, you know, I just feel quite privileged and quite luxury to be able to go, but also to aspire to be able to continue to go within this region for years to come. You know, when I was growing up, we would hear places like the Maldives or Bali. The Seychelles or Bali or, you know, Bahamas or St. Barts or Turks and Caicos Island or, you know, all these places, the Caribbean and whatever. And then people go, you know, Fiji or these kind of, you know.
It looked way better than the Caribbean.
Yeah.
I'll tell you that.
Yeah,
well,
it is what it is. I just think it's just interesting. I think there is definitely something on par. And you marry this beautiful landscape with the global hospitality standards, with Saudi Arabian hospitality, that Bedouin, that Arabian hospitality touch of the, you know, the little things.
Yeah,
you know,
really extra. Yeah,
the bakour, the, you know, the sort of welcome greetings, the, you know, the little touches that they do, the Arabic kahwa.
Do you like
bakour? Oh, yeah, I'm not brilliant on sense, but, like, I just appreciate sort of the uniqueness of Arabian hospitality.
Yeah.
I know it's a difference, and I know it's a USP, and I think they know too. And any time I've stayed or, you know, been involved in projects that have double down on this, you just know that they'll have something to offer. They have something that's probably not just on par, because to be on par, you can have a 5-star hotel anywhere in the world and you won't know the difference. You know, the Wynn Resort is opening in Ras Al Khaimah, right? The Wynn Resort in Ras Al Khaimah or the Wynn Resort in Vegas, if you fly in, you can probably expect similar standards. It's that sort of extra touch. It's that extra hospitality, that extra touch of knowing that you're in the Arabian Peninsula or whatever, is a bit of a USP. And I think the ones that, the resorts that get it right, have that. Alula has that.
Wow, I think
Habitas and Alula, wow.
You know, when you mentioned that, Bahur, it just made me so happy to hear that, because you're Western, that you like appreciate that. Because, you know, for me, I grew up with Bahur. It's always in my house. And, you know, Rich, when I'm out of the house, like even when I'm at work, the most thing I look forward to when stepping into my home is actually the smell of Bahur. It like engulfs you. It's almost like clean. It's something different. So the fact that they're incorporating that, best believe it will be on one of my lists one day. But for our next topic,
Can we just talk a little bit more about Saudi? Sorry,
yeah, sorry,
before
go
we finish.
On.
I know it's a good topic to move on to, a fourth story, but our fifth story. But I spoke to someone yesterday, and we were talking about Saudi giga projects. And the way it was presented to me, it was like, I don't know what you've heard, right? As in, like, oh, there's gossip around this stuff, whisper, whisper, you know, it's negative,
yeah,
or whatever.
Same.
And then the person continued with two or three pretty poignant negative things around these projects.
I wonder where they're from.
Well, let's not go there.
Okay.
But no, because that's not really the point. It's just the, you know, and I know you've talked on this show, because I listen to the show every day with you and Majid, and I know you've talked about this sort of like century project, and, you know, quite aspirational, and it is. It's amazing what's happening. But do people know how things get built? Like, and do people know that, like, someone mentioned that one of the islands is sinking or whatever. And I was just kind of like, what does that even mean? Who says that, right? Like, people used to say, I remember once I went to the Maldives, and people were like, oh, yeah, this is going to be underwater. And they've been saying that about the Maldives for 100 years.
Yeah, and people are still going.
But it's not underwater.
Yeah.
No, but you know what I mean? And like, it's just continuing this, you know, this negative little layer of things. And it's just sort of like, it's unnecessary. It really is. Like, you know, I think anyone who understands what projects have been built in the region, luckily the UAE and the Emirates are mature about communicating now, and as they always have been. But when someone criticizes one project, they say, well, of the 10, 7 are massively successful. For every Burj Khalifa, Palm Jumeirah, some of the other projects have slowed down. I remember, and I've probably mentioned it in the show before, I remember, you know, there's some negativity about one of the development areas in Dubai, and Hassan Sheikh Mohammed came out and said, it's okay. You know, someone who is known for driving things forward and never accepting missing a deadline and really being the driving force behind visionary things like Museum of the Future and many, many other things, it's kind of like, we're at a stage now where we've got so many different projects that if one stretches out, we're in control. We're in control of the delivery of that. It's not existential for Dubai if a project misses a deadline. It's okay. It's okay. You don't have to hide behind that there's a project under construction.
Or the budgets are increasing.
Yeah, or things pivot. Like, a good entrepreneur or a good leader knows where to put their resources, capital resource or capital allocation. They know where to move. They know the things. And the Minister of Economy for Saudi Arabia did a 3-hour Arabic podcast on Finjan with Tamania about a year ago, and he mentioned that, you know, we have to look at Vision 2030, the landmark of that has KPIs about employment, about other things, and KOL, quality of life, and things like that. It doesn't have necessarily KPIs around one particular giga project. You know, when Qadzia and when NEOM and when those giga projects were announced, there was no real announcement of Dariya. Dariya was a development, now it's a giga project. Or New Murabba was a development, now it's a giga project. Because if you look at the hotel keys that are being built in Dariya, unbelievable. Like, you know, whenever I go there, I'm just kind of like, do people know that there's another city here? Like, do people really realize how beautiful even the initial food area is on the entrance that's like 1% of what's going to happen? And then the people say, oh, they'll never finish these hotels. Just like they said that Qatar will never have enough keys to hotel rooms to fit the World Cup, or, you know, and then they do, and then it's successful, and then people are like, people forget that they were so negative, you know? But anyway, so all these projects, people are like, the NEOM will finish. MBS is younger than me. You're like, NEOM will finish. It's just, you know, there's just stories to how it happens, right? And it will be future. It will be something that we don't understand in terms of livability, in terms of economics, in terms of life. It will be completely different. And it'll probably, when it lands ward, when it's full of people in whatever period, people will be like, Well, this is obvious. Obviously, someone was going to do this because the world has changed. There's climate, there's
remote
work.
They'll undermine them.
But they'd be like, yeah, clearly we need this. But when it was thought of at the start, the requirement of cities now is different to what the requirement of cities will be in the future. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Dubai is always evolving into the future. And, you know, the Qiddiya, I remember going to Qiddiya, the Six Flags project, the outside Riyadh, on a bus, like probably 6 years ago or 7 years ago. And that the 3D model that we were shown as a tour back then has changed, I think, three times. It's changed a lot, and it's completely different. But going back to the minister, and I think I mentioned it on the show before, he said, okay, well, we won Expo 2030 in Riyadh. We won FIFA World Cup in Saudi in 2034. 8 of the 11 stadiums for FIFA 2034 are going to be built in Riyadh, are going to be hosted in Riyadh. Mm. And we have the Sports Boulevard. So, well, obviously, with that time frame, obviously the dial periods of NEOM stretches and the focus to deliver Riyadh speeds up. Mm. And then you go, that's kind of smart, because Riyadh is the capital, 8 to 10 million people. Tadawul, everything listed. Riyadh's the home of the current king and the crown prince. And then you've got Giga Project New Morabit, you've got the Sports Boulevard, you've got, New Morabit is northwest, Dalia is west, and Qiddiya is south, sort of west. So you've got three extra Giga Projects around Riyadh, which is already a quite, sprawling city, a kind of flat sprawling city. And it's even going to get bigger. You've got Diplomatic Quarter, you've got other mountainous areas. So, you know, to think of Saudi and how to navigate Saudi as an investor and entrepreneur, really you should be thinking about Riyadh. Yeah, there are loads of other 13 regions. It's huge. And Alula is amazing. And Red Sea is unbelievable as a tourist thing. And, you know, Trojina and all this stuff happening in NEOM. And then Sharjah and, you know, the southern part where the coffees are, and Jizan, and then obviously Mecca, Medina, the holy cities, and then you've got the Red Sea coast. You've got all these areas, but the economic driving force in the next 10 years is really, really Riyadh.
Mm, you said something, Richard, that caught my attention. You were talking about the Dubai ruler, His Highness Sheikh Mohammed, and I think this isn't something that's spotlighted often, but with Burj Khalifa, the story goes is that, yes, Mohammed Al-Abbar, he's great. He's done great with Amar. He's the founder of Amar, although they reported a loss of profits recently. But the point is that it was Sheikh Mohammed who went to him and said, hey, like, build me the tallest building in the UAE. And he was the one who gave him that funding. So, and with the budgets, it's like, I always mention this study because, it's been argued that beyond budgeting by Hope and Fraser, it's the best way to go, that budgets shouldn't be stringent, that the best kind of projects are ones that allow the budget to be flexible and allow the budget to be adapted every like 3 to 6 months, depending on changes that the project will endure. Because in the end of the day, things change, political climates change, economic climates change. We're seeing that right now with the tariffs. So of course these budgets are going to change. And I remember I actually heard a rumor that, since last year, they actually started doing these budget cuts, and it was across a lot of things, even like the arts. But I don't think that's a bad thing whatsoever.
It's not a bad thing.
2030 is coming up soon.
Sure. When I went to Riyadh first 15 years ago, they showed me Riyadh Al Financial District, and they were like, that'll never be finished. And now it's amazing. Like, the metro's opened. It's amazing place. It attracts global companies. You kind of have to have this timeline around it, Like, Rome wasn't built in a day, but moving on to the next story.
Yes, moving on to the next story, and our final one for today. Women have invested 118 billion dirhams in Dubai real estate sector. Now, in Dubai, women investors, they made such a significant impact in 2024, and that was the number that they contributed. It was actually through 50,000 property transactions, and that's according to Majida Ali Rashid, CEO of the real estate development sector at the Dubai Land Department. Now, you know, with this topic, Rich, the reason why I find it so inspiring is because, you know, even I see on my TikTok, you know, all these like Dubai influencers recently, they're all saying, they're all women, and they're all saying like, we're investing in real estate. And even recently, we saw how Safa Siddiqui, she became like a CEO, I think it was Decision, I really should know the name Decisive Living, yes. She became the CEO of Decisive Living, although a little birdie did tell me that that may be a publicity stunt. Do you think that?
Well, you know, the guys behind Decisive Zone, their partners at Love in Dubai, and they're really good at like setting businesses up and things like that. And she, you know, because of Safa's sort of creativity and influence online and links to Dubai Bling, brand ambassador role does fit, but clearly she's an entrepreneurial person as well. She's got a clothing line, and you know, moving into real estate is a smart play. So there probably is substance to it. I don't think it's, you know, I think there's things that are clearly brand ambassador publicity, but I think if it's a structural company, you know, and I know the size of that brand does go into other areas, so the fact that they're moving into living, it doesn't really surprise me. But yeah, going back, I just want to comment and compliment Dubai Land Department on this transparency, because without sharing this information, we don't really know how to celebrate these stories. And you know, to pull this report together, you know, 24% of all real estate transactions in the city are done by women. I don't think many people would have expected that. You know, and I think that's come from a lower base. I think it'll only grow up, and you know, hopefully it becomes 50-50 soon. But you know, it's impressive to you know the CEO that announced this, and also Mahmoud at Dubai Land Department and his team. Like, you know, I've met with them, and they're quite advanced in how they're thinking. We've covered some of the other stories that they've done before in terms of you know, tokenizing real estate in UAE and Dubai, and yeah, it's just quite impressive. So. Rashid confirmed that the future phases will focus on expanding policies that support female investors through incentives, advisory services, and increased leadership representation.
And I, you know, when it comes to this topic, Rich, I think it hits such a, you know, it hits really close to home for me, because especially as a young woman, you know, these are the kind of stories that you want to hear, especially in the Arab world where, you know, you're constantly hearing that women are held back, that they're not, you know, given agency and independence over their own lives. So the fact that, you know, 30% of real estate transactions in Dubai, that, you know, they're women. And key initiatives already in place include the Real Estate Empowerment Program, which has actually attracted over 1,000 women into the sector, and the Dubai Real Estate Brokers Program, designed to increase female participation in brokerage. So this is, you know, we're going to end it on an inspiring note today.
Yeah.
Thank you for tuning into the Smashy Business Show. Make sure to follow us across all social media channels and stay ahead with our daily newsletter. You'll find the subscription link in the description. This is Smashy Business Show, a Smashy Business production, a part of the Augustus Media Podcast Network. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ward.
We loved having you today, Rich, and thank you to our 1.5 monthly listeners across all platforms. You make this possible, and the weekend is almost near. Bye.
Bye-bye.